today, the identity of them, is the fact that the older cars were comprised of a number of components. Mm-hmm. The cars had an expression, a definite facial expression. Mm-hmm. They had a grill. They had placement of headlamps. Mm-hmm. And the fenders had individual shapes. And so that it was it became a much more clear identity package than today's loaf of bread. What we have today is like a loaf of rye bread. And the only identity is through the adornment of attached moldings and gouges in the side of it and whatnot to distinguish from just, as I say, a droopy-looking loaf of bread. And the later ones today look like a box. I mean, the front ends are squared off, and they look like anything anything but something that's supposed to move through the air. Mm-hmm. Some of the latest ads talk about the wind tunnel and the streamline. Well, I think some of those older cars, like some of the old Chryslers and some of the old Cadillacs, were, if anything, better streamlined than these so-called cars today. Mm-hmm. At least they had beautiful tapered fenders. Mm-hmm. They had beautifully shaped headlamps. And each make of car had its own expression, mm-hmm. just like a man's face, the ears and the nose and the eyes mm-hmm. and the mouth. Mm-hmm. The mouth being the bumper, the nose being the grill, and the eyes being the headlamps. They were all placed in very interesting ways in relation to each other. Mm-hmm. That's the reason the cars have character. Today the car has no character at all. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And people look at it and they wonder why some of those old cars look so beautiful. Gee, some of those it would have been around 35, 36, some of those old big old Chrysler straight eights, you know, those beautiful fenders and mm-hmm. long, beautiful hood. But their only problem was in those days the chassis frame was so high off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't able to get the car down to look low. And in order to reduce the apparent height of it, they kept the belt rail very high. And consequently, they had these little peephole windows about 12 inches high. And you sat up to your neck in automobiles. That was one thing we were able to break away from in the Continental. Mm-hmm. We chopped about 4 or 5 inches out of the height of the hood. Mm. We finally got together with the engineering people and developed a new air cleaner and a few other changes they made under the hood, which are just commonplace today, but they screamed and hooped and hollered. And,
mm-hmm.
But that was one reason the car looked nicely balanced, is because you weren't up to your bosoms in automobile.
Right,
see?
Exactly.
But those are some of the things that makes the older cars creates the appreciation for the appearance of them.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say they had beautifully shaped fenders and some of the bumpers were horrible looking, but it was the composition that made them look good.
Right.
Some of them look spunky. Some of them look sassy. Some of them look droopy. Some look terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But they at least had their own identity.
Right.
Yeah.
That's very, very good, very interesting. Can you tell us a bit, give us a somewhat detailed sketch of Mr. Ford's personality as you experienced it?
Edsel Ford.
Mr. Edsel Ford, yes, right, yes.
He didn't have very much personality. He was very, very quiet, very, very reserved, unassuming man. He
mm-hmm.
he rarely ever exhibited enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
And he rarely ever exhibited extreme distaste,
mm-hmm.
and it was very difficult to know without very constant association with him how his feelings ran.
Mm-hmm.
He never was a very unemotional man,
mm.
and maybe he practiced that, or maybe that was his
defense.
Yes, I think he kept he kept apart from the masses that way. He didn't want to be influenced. Mm-hmm. He didn't care to be influenced by people.
Mm-hmm.
He had his own way of determining whether it was something he liked or met with his taste.
Mm-hmm.
And his taste was, of course, extremely conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether he just didn't care or didn't dare stick his neck out toward anything that was spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just his nature. And he always felt he was on safe ground by following a good middle ground.
Uh-huh, yeah. Since he had no technical...
No. He never discussed technical things. Mm-hmm. And he had no time for small talk at all.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely none.
That's interesting.
No. Mm-hmm. Oh, we'd have a little chit-chat, you know, about some little simple thing, but
yeah.
I don't know whether he did with others, he might have, I don't know, but I never saw him enthused or laugh about anything with anyone. He's always pretty solemn, like a preacher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He never knew what was going on inside of his head.
I understand the kids used to come around the lab
yeah?
a lot.
Yeah, Saturday mornings. Saturday mornings he'd bring them in there. Usually that's when they worked Saturday back in the old days.
Henry and Benson
and Billy. And they used to, the floor polishers, they used to have those big floor polishers on that teak floor in the engineering lab.
Right.
And they'd jump on those floor polishers to the consternation of the boys that were pushing them around, and they'd ride on the floor polishers, you know. Henry too, of course, was a kind of roly-poly.
Yes, as a child, yeah.
Referred to him as a round-bottom boy, you know, he's kind of wobbly and typical overweight youngster.
Mm-hmm.
And, I guess he is today. Every time I've seen him, he's...
slimmed down a bit these days.
I guess he has. I saw him in Evie and I were aboard his boat down Daytona. He came up to races, and I guess it was 1964.
Mm-hmm.
And he had his boat there, and that was about the time he was... making connections with this Italian beauty.
Oh, yes.
And mm-hmm. he was in the telephone booth there one afternoon. And Evie and I, we had a boat there at the time, and mm-hmm. the boat works, and he asked us aboard, and we went aboard and spent an hour or so and talked about old times. And he had a Mr. Patterson on there, one of the men from the Rouge plant, and he also had American Motors, what's his name, Chapin.
Roy Chapin Jr.
He was an old school buddy, you know, mm-hmm. they were kids in school together there.
Right. Uh-huh.
And he was with him there on that occasion. They'd come up to the races in Daytona, you know, the
mm-hmm. right.
500-mile racer with Allen was.
Yes.
And so we, Evie and I, went aboard and had a couple of drinks with him. But I've seen him on occasion. We always mm-hmm. always get along fine. Anything I want, usually from the company, we're able to arrange it. A little favor here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But I was too bad about Ben, though. He'd never taken an interest in the company, you know. He'd just stand there, kind of a silly grin on his face, you know. And
yeah.
He never worked.
Mm-hmm. Right. Henry worked hard, though.
He did. He put in a day's work. He really did great things there. I know that when he came back to the company, the very first morning he came back, it was in August, 1943, I guess it would have been, yeah. And, 44, yeah. He got out of the Navy. He came in the back door of my office and he says, Father told me to start here.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
And, we had quite a discussion and, we drove over to the Lincoln plant. I told him there were some problems over there getting things going, and we drove over there and talked to Robbie over there. After that, he never showed any interest in design at all. I mean, it was difficult to I couldn't assume full responsibility for this thing, and there was no one left except to back me up.
Mm-hmm.
As far as okaying this or okaying that, and which his father had always done, you know, see?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I thought that he'd fit in and more or less take up where his father left off, but he was not even conversant with it. He acted bored with it.
Interesting.
Yeah, he acted bored with it, and I think that's one of the reasons he was willing to turn the whole damn shoot match over to Breach and
mm-hmm.
let Breach make whatever plans for design that he wanted to make. I think that's the way it came about.
Mm.
So I was kind of left at a standstill there, and I didn't care to work under those conditions. It was awkward for me. I mean, there were no other company officials that assume any responsibility.
You're afraid to.
Well, that's the way it was set up. The place hadn't been reorganized on any basis. I mean, they hadn't had any committees or anything like that. That came along later on.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm afraid it came along in such a way that I wouldn't have appealed to me at all. I mean, it didn't... I like the simplicity of working with Edsel Ford and working out our decisions and worked out to everyone's satisfaction. I mean, it was a totally different picture, mm-hmm. entirely different situation.
Right.
And I knew that Henry Ford had his hands full with other complicated situations. I mean, perhaps much more important than the design of the product at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had labor problems, they had production problems, and all kinds of things.
Right.
And he just didn't take to the discussion of the automobile design. Show him an instrument panel, and well, you know, he just, yeah, go ahead.
Let me take you back to the late 30s again. And you've set up the styling studio, and you've got a good bunch of trainees and working under you, and you have the year and the confidence of Edsel Ford, and you're working now on the Continental. Did you have interference from the old man himself? Was there ever
no way?
Okay,
no, the only interference that we have had was from all the likes of Charlie Sorensen. And
what ways would he interfere?
Well, production headaches,
yeah, okay,
things like that, you
right.
know. He, if he thought stampings are too deep or something, mm-hmm. in other words, he was hedging against production problems.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He hadn't gotten used to changes, you know, every year,
right.
see?
Yeah.
And Crawford. John Crawford.
Tell us about John.
Well, John Crawford was a big burly Scotchman with a heavy brogue.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been Edsel Ford's mentor from the time he was in school, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Very fine looking man. And apparently he was sort of a production counsel for Edsel Ford. And I remember one occasion when we got into some sort of a heated argument about some part of the car, I forgot what it was, and I was probably got a little hot under the collar. I used to kind of become over-enthused about some things.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, the discussion got going, and Mr. Ford left and went home. It was late in the afternoon. Crawford came up to me. He said, I asked Mr. Ford. He says, imagine talking to Mr. Ford like you did. If I was him, you'd have your check and be out of here by now. And I just kind of laughed, and I said, well, Mr. Crawford, that's the way it is. And I said, I think Mr. Ford will see it differently when he comes in tomorrow and thinks about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just took the chance. I thought, well, I'm going to move ahead, and I'm not going to get stuck in a nice jam here.
Remember the detail over which this occurred?
Oh, I don't know, something about some sheet metal or some hood shape or some damn thing. I've forgotten what it was, but we'd get into a... He was trying to protect Mr. Ford from buying some idea that he had, and he thought it might cost 15 cents or some damn thing, you know. He was running interference, see?
Mm-hmm.
But I got along fine with him. He finally respected my judgment, and he was a lot older man, of course, and I was old enough to be my daddy.
Mm-hmm.
And they just couldn't get used to a young guy blowing off that way and having Mr. Ford's confidence, and I was... line, Mr. Ford standing in line me to express myself about something, see, that was never been done before.
Mm.
And it kind of unsettled him a little bit.
Mm.
But after a couple of years, things worked out,
and
we used to joke about it afterwards, you know.
But he sort of was Edsel's production troubleshooter.
Kind of a right-hand man, you know, right in Mr. Ford's office. And he handled a lot of intermediate production problems and so on. He had a working knowledge of production, and he was one of the round table group, we call them. They all had lunch together in the dining room out in back of the engineering lab. There was Cowling, who used to be sales manager, and then there was Weibel, who was purchasing agent.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the finance man, Bert, that was his name. Craig. Craig, yeah, yeah, yeah.
E.B. Craig, yeah.
Yeah, he was the finance man. He was he was the only one of the group that looked like a high-priced executive. I mean, he might be a board member of Morgan & Company or something like that. He dressed nicely and had a nice gentlemanly way about him, but the rest of them, they're rough, you know. They'd come up in the shop, so to speak, old Pete Martin. And,
what about Pete Martin? Tell me about it.
Well, Pete Martin was a counterbalance for Charlie Sorensen.
Mm.
no one ever could say which was the had the upper hand or which didn't, and old man Ford would play one against the other one, see?
He gave Martin the vice presidency before he gave it to
was it? I'd forgotten how it worked, but anyway. Yeah. he was a rough old son of a bitch. He some guy look at him cross-eyed, you know, was reading a blueprint or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, where's your badge? I'm going to take your badge away for a week. Just go get your pay. Oh, Jesus, I'm telling you, he was brutal.
Mm.
We had one old draftsman there, a head draftsman under Cresselius. They always, his name was Rivard. He was an old countryman from up in upstate Michigan someplace. He looked like an old farmer. Mm. Old Rivard, you know, he wasn't very ambitious. He kind of lazy. He'd sit there at his desk, you know, and they'd all be coming back from lunch, this group, you know, like the Russian consul. And they'd stroll along up the aisle, you know, and all between the desks there, by a thousand feet, you'd see them coming, you know, and they'd walk along and be talking. Rivard would have an old blueprint, see, and he had it cut in the middle, see, and he could cock the blueprint so he could look through there and see it. I used to go up, tap him on the back and say, "Rivard, what do they look like today?" He'd say, "Ah, I'm just looking at something here in the dimension."
What did Rivard do?
He'd just peek at him, you know.
I mean, what was his? What were his duties?
Oh, he was under Cresselius there. He was a draft, you know, head of the drafting group.
Yeah.
He's an old buggy man, an old horse carriage man. He'd come up through the rank for the horses and carriages.
What about Bennett? Did you have any input or contact with him?
Yeah, I
Harry
used to.
Bennett?
Yeah. I had no dealings with him particularly, but along toward the end.
Yeah, more so.
After Edsel Ford died, it seemed that I used to be asked frequently by newspaper people, magazine people, you know, for comments and articles and all that. And it was decided by someone that it should all be cleared through Harry Bennett.
Yes.
And but I got along all right with Bennett. I mean, I started to draw up a boat for him.
Yes, he liked boats too.
Well, yeah,
he was out on Gross Hill there at one point.
He had a house down there and a boat dock.
A Chinese pagoda.
Yeah, some damn thing down there. And anyway, of course he was a highway robber. he and the guy in the farm garage, Dallinger.
Ray Dallinger.
Yeah, right. Did you ever read that book, you know? That,
oh, yes.
That thing about Dallinger's wife and all that?
Written by the son.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, anyway.
He just died recently.
I don't know why he had my name in there. I don't have anything to do with him. Mm. But Ray and I used to have a lot of dealings together because every time I wanted to get a hold of a car or something, you know, or have a truck sent down to my house to haul some gravel for a weekend and so on, Ray would always fix it up for me, see?
Mm-hmm.
And if I wanted to buy one of the company cars, one of the experimental cars or station wagon or something like that that they had.
Watch the cord, yeah.
Because Ray was right next to the old man, you know, Ray was as close to the old man as they could get.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray looked after the farm garage.
And what constituted the test driving at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray would see about buying the outside cars, what they call the foreign cars, you know.
Yes.
A couple of General Motors, Buicks, and a couple of Oldsmobiles, and 20 or 30 cars every year they'd buy, see.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Ray would make the deal with the dealers in town, if I wanted a car of some kind or use a company car, you know, to take a trip or something, Ray would always have it for me. Ray and I worked close together.
That's good.
Of course, Ray knew where I stood, too, so he was...
Mm-hmm. Sure, of course.
It was fine. It was all right. So anything I wanted like that, like, Ray was always nice. But I knew Ray was working the angle, see? And he knew I knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray had a couple of farms out back there. And he had horse vans, trotting horses, and all kinds of stuff. You know, he'd build the vans and Ford shops, and well, with Mr. Ford's permission. I mean,
it's
all right. Mm-hmm. Can't stop him.
Mm-hmm.
I had borrowed a Ford touring car one weekend to go up to Marine City. I bought a boat up there, and I had to go up and get some cushions from it. And I didn't have a station wagon at the time. I just had that Ford Speedster, that kind of a race car thing.
Mm-hmm.
I borrowed a car, and that weekend, some boys came up, helped me clean the boat up. And, we had some wine, we had some drinks and all that kind of stuff. We made a kind of party out of it. And Monday morning, I brought the cushions back home and took the car out. Ray's, I sent it out there with my man at the office, and I got a call from Ray about 20 minutes after that. He said, "Bob," he said, "gee whiz," he said, "we almost had an accident here." He said, "You know that car you had?" He said, "The man went to drive it to the wash rack." He said, a wine bottle came out and got under his foot, and he couldn't put the brake on. I said, I had a couple of playboys up there help me with a boat, and they used the car a little bit, and they went up the store, and I said, "That's how it happened." I said, "My goodness, I would give any of the world to have that happen."
It must have been something.
He said, "Suppose Mr. Fawn had been there." I said, "That's where it was." Oh, God, I tell you.
Did you help Mr. Hensleford with any of his boats that he had?
No, we used to discuss the boats, and he had a couple. He had a big speedboat out at his house there, and he had a sailboat called the Buckeye.
Oh yes.
Then I guess he had another boat he kept up in Maine, up at Seal Harbor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we used to talk boats. He had a big houseboat that he used in Florida, about 120 foot long.
Yeah.
But outside of that, I didn't. We just talk boats, and he'd bring me clippings of boats, and we just talk back and forth.
Did you get to know Mrs. Ford at all?
Not too well. I used to see her at. We set up a. They had a showing at the Detroit Institute of Arts. All way back, 31, I guess it was,
mm-hmm.
32,
mm-hmm.
And in one of those little side streets down off Woodward Avenue, and she was instrumental in promoting this thing. She and Mrs. Alger and a half a dozen of those high-toned, sable-coated ladies up there in
Grosse Pointe. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I got to know Mrs. Edsel Ford on that occasion. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the only contact I ever had with her. But
she's a great lady, I think.
Very nice, very fine gal, yeah. He was very disappointed about the boys' lack of interest in some of the things he was interested in.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, as I say, I didn't have any discussion between them or with them, but I mean, from things he'd tell me and things I gathered and put together, they never cared for boats or anything like that. It's too bad. But
he had a number of boats.
Oh yeah.
In the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But he didn't have any. He just told me there's nobody in the family enjoys it.
Really?
I don't know whether she enjoyed it or not. I doubt it. I don't know. But he used to go to Seal Harbor in the summer. You know, he had a nice place up there.
Yeah.
Mount Desert Island.
A Nelson Rockefeller at one point in the mid-30s liked a French Ford. Was that what it was? He saw something on the continent. I guess you and Mr. Ford had put together something like a Jensen Ford, a French red convertible or something. Do you remember that?
Well, that isn't that speedster that I built for him. I built
that's
a speedster. Or the cycle fenders and all, and well, you know the.
What about that second speedster? Yeah, you did the one, the boat tail, and then you.
Well, there was another boat tail I booked for him.
Yeah, when was that?
That cycle fenders. That was in the summer of '34.
Yes.
I have pictures over on the board over there.
And he enjoyed that very much.
Yeah.
Didn't he?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
He kept that out of his house there. He had a couple private roads he'd drive around on out there.
Gawker Point.
Yeah. That car turned up in California somewhere, too.
Really?
And the second Continental, which I acquired, the second handmade Continental,
yes. Mm-hmm.
I acquired that, kept it a couple of years, and I sold it to a Boy, so I guess I had my man take it down, sold a used car lot down in Livernois Avenue.
Mm.
And I moved to a new place, and I had to have room. And I had 3 or 4 cars around there, little mm-hmm. English Ford touring car that Edsel Ford gave me, and a couple of others.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a few of the foreign bodybuilders built custom bodies on Fords, you know, which
right.
they only appeared in Europe. They didn't
mm-hmm.
appear in this country at all.
Yeah.
And it's quite likely if that's what you're referring to.
Nelson Rockefeller took a fancy to this, and so he wanted one, and so he wrote to Edsel Ford.
Hmm.
Edsel had one made up for him in France.
Well, I could be through the French Ford company. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, quite a number of the Italian and the German custom body people would build custom bodies on Fords over there,
mm-hmm.
and they'd sell them through the Ford dealers and whatnot.
Right.
I don't know what the arrangement was,
yeah.
but every now and then Edsel Ford would have one sent over or something. But we never saw. They kept them out of the house.
Right.
The only time you see them, they sent them into
yeah.
the shop for some work to be done.
Looking back on it, the Continental must have been a very satisfying part of your design career at Ford, wasn't it?
Well, it turned out to be.
Mm-hmm. But your perspective was quite different at the time.
It was just another special built car, which
mm-hmm.
I'd built many for Edsel Ford.
Right, yeah.
And it was inconceivable to me the attention that was paid to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as I say, there wasn't much design effort went into it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just it was a happy combination.
Uh-huh.
It was so simple that people can't understand it. There wasn't months and months of models and drawings and all the damn things they go through nowadays. I put together so many cars like that and built them for myself, you know, just out of odds and ends. So it was just
mm-hmm.
like a backyard project.
Well, it came together in a beautiful way.
It did.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, it gave the Lincoln the prestige that it needed. You see,
it
came at a time when the custom bodied Lincoln, the prestige Lincoln line was gone.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing but the Zephyr.
Right.
There was no class to exhibit. There was no opportunity to exhibit class on the Zephyr, if you want to put it that way.
Right.
It
mm-hmm.
didn't lend itself to custom bodies. It didn't have a chassis. In the meantime, all the custom body builders had gone out of business. So that Mr. Ford really had very little to practice his delight on in an unusual automobile.
Mm-hmm.
Gave him the it came about at just the right time to give him an outlet for that type of thinking. Not to mention the prestige that it gave
mm-hmm.
the Lincoln.
Yeah, and it just took off in terms of sales.
Yeah, yeah.
Of that type of car.
Unfortunately, the war came along just
mm-hmm.
then, it wasn't able to expand, of course, during that 3 or 4 years, and by the time the war was over, why the management was in a turmoil, and that was the last thing they were interested in. It was producing a Continental.
Mm-hmm.
They were reluctant to even pick up where they left off
mm-hmm.
on the 48 and 49, you know, 47, 48, I guess it'd be 46, 47, 48, I guess they built it after the war.
Mm-hmm. But in retrospective, it was a remarkable achievement.
It was. I mean, considering how little engineering went into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, they claimed they didn't make any money on it. I had a doubt if they did.
Did you? What engine did you use in those days?
It was the regular standard Zephyr engine.
Yeah.
Lincoln
right.
Zephyr, 12-cylinder.
No.
No.
Mm-hmm.
No. It's too bad. Well, many of the owners, the ones that bought them in later years, put Ford engines or Mercury engines in them. You know.
Did they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They. A little more beef, a little more substantial.
Yeah.
And
right.
Yeah, that Zephyr engine wasn't a car you could get out and drive 70 miles an hour and all day long. It would give out.
Mm.
Very poor engineering, awful.
Mm.
I think that was a great disappointment for Edsel Ford, too. The car had a bad reputation mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the Lincoln dealership was fragmented. They didn't have the big old K model, and it was mixed up with Ford sales. And
mm-hmm.
and then... finally, the Mercury came along, and they combined the Zephyr and the Mercury sales. You know, Lincoln Mercury.
Right.
That's where
yes.
the Lincoln Mercury combination
mm-hmm.
came in,
right.
And also it lent a little more prestige to the Mercury, not being associated with the Ford.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thing where Mr. Ford and I had a little funny feeling. You know, I knew that the car had to be separated for people to want to buy it.
Right.
They didn't
yeah.
want to buy it as an expanded Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And he
wanted a completely new car.
Yeah, well, that's the reason they wanted to step up socially.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason he did everything to cuss me out that night because I brought this fact out.
It seems odd. He was willing to make the break with the Continental, but not with the Mercury.
Well, the Continental wasn't tied in with the Ford, see?
True.
That was already a prestige name, and that was one of the reasons he was agreeable to build it in the Lincoln plan when I suggested it, because I pointed out the fact that being a custom-built car, they're going to have to get considerably more money for it, and you can get more money for the Lincoln name than you could a Mercury name.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if we'd used the Mercury as a foundation, we'd gone through the same operation, but still had the name of a lower-priced car.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he bought that logic.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
But when it came to naming the Mercury, was where we ran into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You see, all the nameplates and all the discussion of the car up until the time of production,
mm-hmm,
was Ford Mercury. Ford Mercury, see?
Yeah.
And I could see that was a big mistake. And I wasn't the only one. It was the salespeople and they said, my God, we got to get the Ford name off the car. Boy, that's like, you know, a hot poker out of Mr. Ford.
Oh, yes.
What's wrong with the Ford name? We spent 39 years building it up, and you're telling me it isn't good enough to put on this automobile? So what the hell are you going to say? See?
Yeah.
Man, I was bracketed.
Did you have any input, as you must have, in the design of the Mercury?
Oh, yeah, sure. We did the whole thing.
Is there any particular story about that you'd like to save for posterity?
Not particularly. It was just modeled up front end. He satisfied him with the front end, and we made several versions of it, but we always kept coming back to that typical Ford-type front end. He liked that, and
mm-hmm,
we did some interesting things with the hood. Put that little speed stream on the hood there and fatten the body up as much as we could to, you know, mm-hmm, give the feeling of a little more automobile.
Right.
But then we had that little hardtop coupe with the window channels, you know.
Yes.
Kind of like the Cadillac 61 or whatever it was, you know, kind of a custom look with the chrome frame windows.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And outside of that, it was just a routine, mm-hmm, process. The car wasn't spectacular in any way. People liked it. As a matter of fact, it gave good service. It was,
mm-hmm,
tough.
Yeah.
My God, when I stopped to think now, that car came out, it was about $850.
Mm, a lot.
A lot. Man, compared to one of Mercury today, $14,500. Yelling on television for a goddamn Mercury.
Those are grand.
I told people I know that car, that's 10 times, it's 12 times.
But you can sell it a lot of money in those days.
It was. Well, the Ford went then for about $650,
right.
$650, $700.
Mm-hmm.
You could buy a nice Ford pickup for $550.
Mm-hmm.
Now a pickup's $11,000.
I know.
It's wild. Wild.
Yeah.
Well, we were paying 75 cents an hour then for draftsmen.
Mm-hmm.
75 cents for pattern makers. That was in
1934. Right.
Woo! Those were the days, huh?
They certainly were. Well, the war comes on in February of 42. You're completely suspended the production, are you not?
The production, yeah. We kept
going. We kept going.
We only about 25% of the people. I mean, we, mm-hmm, normally had about 75, 80 at that time.
Uh-huh.
And I think we were down about 25 or something like that. And, mm-hmm, then, as I say, we worked on a certain amount of government work. We modeled up turrets, shapes and things like that for Willow Run,
yeah,
and enough to justify the boys being there, you know.
Right.
And the government had allowed for a certain amount of time to be spent by people who weren't absolutely essential in the war effort.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we were able to keep going, and so that by the time production was considered again, why we had our post-war facelift jobs ready and stuff,
yes,
of that kind.
Mm-hmm. You had done quite a bit of clay modeling mock-ups
during the war. Yeah, well, of course,
pre-war
and
post-war.
Yeah, it wasn't determined then. After the war, I mean, for the post-war picture, I don't know, we haven't gotten into that.
Mm-hmm, right.
I developed a 90-inch wheelbase Ford. And then there was to be a 114 or something. In other words,
mm-hmm,
it was set up to, for a small Ford and a large Ford.
Right.
See?
Mm-hmm.
And then actually the tooling was started on those. And then when Breech came in, they all got panicky, and they got one of those little Studebakers out there.
Mm-hmm.
What little double-ended Studebaker.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought, oh, well, now that's the size car we want. They said, oh, that's too big for a Ford, you know. The, in the meantime, right after that, boy, they 400 cubic inches and all that. Well, anyway, they turned that Ford into a Mercury. That was the first post-war Mercury, see? Right. Then they took the tooling for this small 90-inch Ford and shipped that to France. They built that in France.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started...
Was that the Vedette?
I guess that's what they call it. Yeah, they used the, yeah, they used the small V8 engine in it,
mm-hmm.
and that little 60-horse V8 engine.
Right.
And then they started out from scratch, and of course that was the 1949
mm-hmm.
Ford.
Right.
It was designed to a formula. I mean, the wheelbase was fixed, and the hip room was fixed, and the headroom, and it was a cage. In other words, all you could do was fill in the cage,
right,
and put Tutti Frutti on the surface. That's about the way that it was worked out.
On the slab sides,
huh? Yeah, I'll say.
Let me go back to, before we get into that very interesting episode.
And that was incidentally Youngren's project. That was when
right.
he took hold there,
yeah.
and they did some things to the engine, and,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
So you're in the midst of World War II, and you're working with a reduced group on various war material.
Yeah.
What sort of projects you remember this in your mind that you did for the military?
We did some camouflage work for some of the branch plants.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a couple of boys on that. We went out to Ann Arbor and they took camouflage lessons from the architectural school out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a couple of trips out there. We enjoyed that. And we took a couple of trips to various government installations to study what the tactics they'd used.
Mm-hmm.
Down Paterson, New Jersey there. We went down there a couple of times to look at some of their plant camouflage arrangements in the parking lots and
mm-hmm.
all that. And then that's about the extent of it.
You work on any of the...
we worked on some truck designs and...
Mm-hmm.
No, we didn't get into that. No, that was all handled at the Roos plant.
Pretty much.
Yeah, it was all mechanical stuff.
You were still at the engineering lab.
Yeah. No, we never got involved in any of that.
Mm-hmm.
No, we just made some models and very low key. And that, of course, was... Edsel Ford was ailing and he didn't get in there after that, really. I mean, he didn't get in. That one trip, when he came back from Hobe Sound, that was in the spring of 43.
Mm-hmm.
He came in that one afternoon for about an hour and never saw him again.
Incredible.
In May he was gone. He died in May.
Very tragic.
Yeah, it was a shame.
Some interesting personnel changes going on at this point, and one at least, which you ran afoul of, Joe Galam?
Mm-hmm.
What, could you tell us a bit about how that happened?
Going back to the time I came there, as soon as Mr. Ford had assigned certain design projects to me,
mm-hmm, right.
Joe Galam felt slighted, of course. He'd always handle that sort of thing with Edsel Ford and
right.
for him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just a natural for an older hand like that to be critical of an upstart who was mm-hmm. More or less taking over.
Right.
His activities. I didn't get interfering with his body engineering or anything like that. He'd always handle that. He was a contact man between Briggs and Murray and
mm-hmm.
the suppliers
right.
and Ford and any selection of work, design development works on the part of Briggs White. He and Edsel Ford would always work together on it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the time I came in, that was all through with. I mean,
mm-hmm.
they that was a different policy then. They,
mm-hmm.
But Joe resented. He gave me a bad time after Edsel Ford died, and he thought, oh boy, I'm going to really fix this guy.
Serlina.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I left there in September.
That's right.
Of 43, and I knew something was going to happen, and I didn't want any arguments with him. So I quit, and I knew that as soon as Henry got back in there, I'd get back,
mm-hmm.
which it did, which mm-hmm. subsequently it worked out that way.
You mentioned Larry Sheldrake a little while ago. He also got fired.
Oh, well, he was fired.
Was that Sorensen who did that?
I don't know. They fired about the same time.
That's it. That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, I don't know how that worked. I don't know why that was
something
to mix
on,
up down the Roos plant there.
Bennett,
he might have been, yeah. I didn't get in on that.
Yeah.
First thing I knew, I That was when I was away from there for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
See, I worked for them three different times. I was three times.
So you started your own design firm?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Where was that?
I was in the Eaton Tower in Detroit, a penthouse up on the 28th floor of Eaton Tower.
Right, yeah. And, doing industrial design work?
Yeah.
Marine design?
No, I hadn't gotten any marine design, but I was doing work for Roman Haas on plastic development work for automotive body trim and all.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did some work for Nash Kelvinator, Nash, and
this was
not automobile work. I was doing on their appliance work. I had a boy working with me there.
Where was that? Do you remember?
I was one of the boys that had been in the office there. Oh, he came a couple of days a week. I just forgot who it was. Mm-hmm. One young chap. Well, anyway, of course, as soon as I went back with Ford, I gave that up. I turned it over to somebody. One of the boys in the office was going to take up if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But
now, how did you get back in? You mentioned briefly that that Henry Ford
II
was brought in.
He got a hold of me and wanted me to come up to his office, and I went up there, and that's the same day that Jack Davis came in there.
Yeah.
He says, now we get things going again.
Oh, yeah.
So, anyway, I went back on the condition that I wouldn't have any interference from certain people that I knew would create problems.
Right.
So I wasn't interested in coming back on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he said, I'll get rid of Joe Glam right now, which he did, right across the table. I felt badly about it. I mean, after all, Joe, I'd known Joe for years, and I'd learned a lot from the old guy. I mean, he was a very capable old engineer, you know. And he started out with his father and his grandfather. And I didn't want to be responsible for firing him, which is what it amounted to, I guess.
Yeah.
And I told him, I said, Mr. Ford, we don't have to do it that way. I said, can't you give me something to do, or, you know, tell him to stay the hell out of my area there?
Right.
He said, get rid of him. That's the way he was. He just pulsing as hell. He grabbed the phone, called up and talked to somebody and said, get rid of Joe, get rid of him. I don't care what you do. Get rid of him. And that was the end of Joe.
Get him out of my sight.
Yeah. A couple of months later, Joe came into my office and wanted to know if I'd get a man to fix a seat cushion on his car.
Oh, no.
I said, sorry. I said, Joe, you don't have to worry about that. I said, he's all right, the damn seat won't work. The seat wouldn't work. And I said, my goodness, we can take care of that. So I called up somebody down the Rouge and told him to put a new seat in Joe's car. I didn't see him after that.
Mm.
Yeah, Joe was well fixed. He's the richest Hungarian in Detroit.
Imagine.
Yeah. Joe made about $100,000 a year back in those days, which is equivalent to half a million today.
Oh, incredible.
Sure. He had a big home out there in Palmer Woods. And I have a funny incident. Is this going here now?
Oh, yes.
I've been over to Briggs. Mm-hmm. This was during the time that Jarda was trying to sell Ford on this rear-engine car.
Right.
And
the one he had in the Chicago Rose.
Or a duplicate of it or something. Well, anyway, they came over to the engineering lab to get a hold of Joe, and they were going to go drive Joe back to the Briggs in this car and see how it went.
Good.
And we got someplace over in Hamtramck there, and it was a nasty, sloppy day with snow on the ground and all. The damn thing broke down.
Oh, no.
And it was sitting in one of these side streets with all these ragamuffins and whatnot, racing around and knocking on the doors and all. And here's little Joe sitting up on the back seat. And some kid looks in and says, oh, look at the funny little man. Joe with his big fedora hat and his leather collared overcoat. Joe said, get the damn kid away. Go on. Get the damn kid away from here. He's supposed to be broken in Hungarian. All I could do was burst out laughing. He didn't want to get out and walk. It was nasty. It was a damn thing. They had to send a tow truck. Carried away. Little Joe sitting in the back seat.
Oh, no. All the way, eh?
Of course, it attracted attention, and all the kids were just getting out of school. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy.
Well, it's 1945, and the war is obviously coming to an end.
Yeah.
You've got to come up with some post-war...
Well, we got into the retrimming the front ends of the
pretty much.
Of the 42 cars, yeah. We worked out some pretty decent front ends.
Yes, you did. Some very good front ends.
Yeah, they worked all right. And they
you had the die still from
The basic tooling, yeah. The hood and the fenders were all the same, and the only changes made were in the grills.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And some little incidental changes. I guess we had new instrument panels and things like that that didn't take too much time to tool up. See.
Right.
But the Zephyr had its new fenders from 42.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that
became Lincoln then. I guess they dropped the Zephyr name.
Yes.
At that point or thereabouts.
Zephyr dropped in 41.
Yeah. So.
And that was a complete redo, wasn't it, the 42? Quite a bit.
Well, same old Zephyr body that went back to 1935.
Never really changed.
Never changed the body, the doors, and the windshield, and the floor pan were all the same. So that was a handicap as far as styling went. But it was a right decent looking car.
Yes,
it was a little out of proportion in places, but like so many of those facelift deals. But it had a big husky looking front end on it. It looked important anyway. But that's about the extent of it. There was no new tooling or as such. It wasn't until we got into the complete post-war stuff. We had the new Lincoln, which we did the post-war Lincoln, and the Mercury, which was to have been the Ford. And then the all-new Ford, of course, which was introduced, in 49?
Late 48.
There again, we made up a model, and then Walker borrowed some of our men, and they made a model, a duplicate of it, practically.
Yes.
Same dimensions and all. And of course, the committee picked Walker's, of course, with the breech, with his crew there and all.
Yeah.
It obviously turned out that way.
Oh, yeah.
So it was at that point I figured, that would be a waste of my time there. So that's when I decided to come to Florida.
Did they take your design and make the Mercury out of it? Is that what you said?
Yeah. Yeah,
so that your design for the 49 Ford became the 49 Mercury.
That's right. Yeah, and also the big Lincoln we designed, the
big Lincoln, the
Cosmopolitan, whatever they call it. And
you had known George Walker previously.
Oh yeah, sure.
But you didn't particularly care for him.
Well, I have nothing against George. No, he
not personally, but I mean in terms of an automobile designer.
No, he George had done work on Nash. You know, he'd done Nash work for quite a number of years.
Had he?
But he was doing some work for some bumper people or something, and he'd come out occasionally, and I knew George. We always got along fine.
But he was a breech man.
Oh, well, sure. He and Ernie Breech were golf buddies, you know. They belonged to the same country club and were neighbors or something out there in Birmingham or where they lived out there.
Had he done any work from GM, George Walker?
Not that I know of, no. That's the only automobile work I know that he ever did was for Nash.
For Nash.
But I couldn't see, that was Breech's tactic, was to inject him in there as a consultant to me, see? In the meantime, he'd be working for Breech. See?
Working on his project.
That's right, yeah. Well, in other words, he wanted to drive a wedge between Henry Ford and myself.
Right, yeah.
So I'd be part of Breech's deal. Matter of fact, my activities were placed under Youngren in engineering, see?
Yes,
And as nice a gent as Youngren was, and I got along fine with Harold, we saw eye to eye, but I could see all kinds of problems shaping up there. I didn't want to get involved in.
Right.
I had enough problems at home. I was separating from wife, and I just didn't care to get involved in it.
Right.
I had ample means to get along. I didn't have to work if I didn't want to, and I said, "Oh, hell with it." I mean, I'd had such a happy relationship with Edsel Ford.
Yeah.
And working the way I had.
Must have been a blow to you.
Oh yeah.
Personally.
Sure. I mean, I just lost heart in the thing. Henry treated me fine. I mean, he boosted my salary up, paid me a lot of money, and that was after they brought Walker in there, you know.
Yes.
Double my salary.
What did you think Henry thought about Walker coming in?
He was just going right along with Breech.
He was.
Sure.
Yeah.
He had no interest in the design department at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he as much as mentioned that, he said it's pretty much out of my hands. He said, we've had Mr. Breach here, and Mr. Breach is making changes. Mm-hmm. And I said, I can well understand that. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't think it would quite fit my, I think I'd be an obstacle in the path of this changeover arrangement. And if it's all right with you, I will part good company. And
well, that's good. You left with goodwill.
Oh, yeah,
and you
sure.
left gracefully.
That's right, that's right. I said, let's put it on a 6 months basis. And I said, after 6 months, if I feel like I come back, I'll get in touch with you. And if you think you'd like to have me back, why, you see how things go. I said, mm-hmm. in the meantime, let this new crew make it work out.
Yeah.
I mean, it was on that basis. I said, I don't mind giving up at this point. I said, there are certain things that I don't care for. And I said, before we get into it and have a hassle over it, I'd rather not stand in the way of it. I said, let Tom Hibbard, who's been a very capable assistant of mine, and I said, let Tom take over, and I'm sure he'll work things out.
Mm-hmm.
And which he did. He stayed on, I guess, 6 months there. And then I don't know, he got some other guy in there. And Tom used to write me a lot about it down in Florida and tell me about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He says, hell, it's awful there. Why don't you come on back? I said, I don't know. It's too late now.
They got Oswald and Schneider.
That was it. Oswald, John, whatever he was. I didn't know who knew him.
Yeah, he came over from GM.
Did he?
Another Breach man.
Yeah, I don't know Schneider either. I never knew him.
Schneider came in. Yeah.
Hmm.
In fact, shortly after you left, as you well know, there was a great influx of GM people.
Oh, sure, and that's what Breach wanted, you know.
Right.
He was sucking all the engineering talent he could out of GM. And that's why Youngren came in there. You know, they have transmission problems to develop an automatic transmission.
Right.
Youngren had been instrumental in that Oldsmobile, what's the original?
The rocket?
No, the hydromatic. You know.
Oh, yes, of course. He developed that.
Yeah, that's right, with the Oldsie.
Mm-hmm, right.
So that was his place there.
Sure.
So he in turn took charge of all engineering,
mm-hmm.
everything, see?
Yes.
And I think he was very capable on transmissions and so on, but he left great big gaps as mm-hmm. far as his knowledge of other subjects are concerned. You see, that was so specialized in the motors. They had transmission men, they had engine men, suspension men, you know, ignition men on down the line.
Mm-hmm.
But I got along fine with Harold when he came in there, but I just didn't care to... Well, we were moving back into an enclosure of the engineering department.
That's right.
And that's one thing I fought with Shelrick about, and mm-hmm. and this group of Lincoln engineers mm-hmm. when I was a kid. I mean, I'd finally gotten things split apart from that.
Mm-hmm.
I put it on more or less of a separate department, under Mr. Ford and myself.
Right.
And man, I wasn't about to step into that again. So that's the kind of, we come full circle about there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what happened after that. I heard all kinds of rumors. I don't know who this guy Oswald was. And I noticed, strangely enough, no one takes credit for designing that Edsel car. You know, the Edsel that...
Oh, yes. Well, that's another whole story. But
yeah, well...
Roy Brown did that, yeah.
I don't know who it was, but I noticed there was a write-up in one of the magazines about Walker when he was elected to the Antique Automobile Club of America,
mm-hmm.
which I'm an honorary member.
Right.
And a couple of years after I was, or 10 years after, they elected Walker, and they gave a little resume of his activities and so on. And it was very pointed in this article. It said, Mr. Walker states that he was not responsible for the design of the Edsel car. Of course he was, went on right when he was there.
Course, yeah.
Maybe sure he had his finger in it.
He was vice president for design.
That's right.
Did you get to know the two lieutenants that he brought with him, Joe Oros and Elwood Engel?
No.
They came in with him on the consultancy, but they worked downtown. And
Well, he had his own studio, I guess, in down the Center Building, New Center Building.
Right. Uh-huh.
And his son, didn't he have a son that took over that business?
I didn't know that. Maybe so, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know them at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, he had a studio or an office down there.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know. I didn't know any of those people.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, we went out of a way to steer clear of other designers from other companies. I never hired a designer from another company directly.
Really?
Never.
That's interesting.
Never. No.
Tom Hibbard was the closest one.
Tom, he didn't come there as a designer as such. Tom was an old timer, you know.
Yeah.
He wasn't a designer working for another company. He had worked for General Motors.
Right.
A few years before that.
Right, yeah.
But I didn't hire Tom, you know.
Oh, I see.
No, he, Tom got in there during the war working on tanks or jeeps or something down in the Rouge plant.
Yeah,
something of that kind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know Tom at all at that time until I came back with the company, and then they had brought Tom up from the Rouge plant to run the design department thing.
Well, that's interesting that you were kept
well,
on.
Then, when Mr. Ford asked me when he took me back in there what I wanted to do with Tom Hibbert, mm-hmm. and I said, my gosh, I said, do you want to know if let fire Tom Hibbert? I said, no, my goodness, no. I said, Tom, I'm sure, is a very capable man. And I said, I want some sort of an assistant there. Tom's been running the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, let me talk to him and we'll see what we work out.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Tom and I, we hit it off right away. He's a splendid man. And mm-hmm. he was damn thankful, you know, that I kept him on there.
Uh-huh.
And as it turned out, he was a great help to me. And he was sufficiently able to talk to people and hire people or, you know, interview possible designers and all that kind of stuff. Kept me out of the lobby a lot, you know, that
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
That's good.
Sure. And so Tom and I, we got along just fine and very able man. Tom didn't do much design. He had good ideas, but he was able to interpret things, and he had a good eye for manufacturing and the practicality of things, but he was a good manager.
Mm-hmm.
And but we worked nicely together and worked out fine. So I didn't feel I was stepping out, leaving the ship without a captain or anything of that kind. And I explained that to Mr. Ford, and I said, as far as I'm concerned, Tom, during these unsettled conditions, I'm sure Tom can work his way through it for you and do a good job.
Mm-hmm. So you left with no regrets?
Oh, no. That's fine. No, I've seen Mr. Ford a number of occasions, and I run into Benson down Palm Beach and different ones, and we get along fine.
Did you think inherently that your design for the 49 Ford was better than the Walker design? Looking back on it,
I couldn't say a hell of a lot of difference. They were designed to a formula. Mm-hmm. The hood was to be so long, and the body was to be so wide.
They'd given you the package before.
Oh, sure, mm-hmm. sure. That was all drawn up by Harold Youngwood. See?
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. The tread was fixed, and the wheel size, and we came up with practically the same sheet metal design. It was you couldn't change it very much. I don't know. The grill was different, and maybe the hubcap design was different, but the car, you put one on the side of the other one. Subsequently, I couldn't tell one from the other one.
Were you in a sense working in separate? You were in the north end.
We were in our old
end.
Department,
and they
set up a petition down the other end of the building.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For Walker to model up this other car with my modelers, with my men.
There's a story I've heard that that somehow or other they got a look at your model.
They could have.
Yeah.
Could very well got a look at it as it developed. Tom Hibbert said when he saw it, he said, for Christ's sakes, it's the same damn car. He said, what have we got all this trouble for?
Yeah. You said earlier that you thought it was Ernie Breech's input.
He ran the committee, the policy committee, and Bugis and all the rest of them, Christ, they were all beholden to him. They're not going to say, gee, let's take Gregory's car, you know.
Yeah.
No, that's what... man, that would have been impossible. I realized that.
Mm-hmm.
I realized that. I told Mr. Ford that. I said, my goodness, there's no way this thing will work.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you got a man here that's running. You've given Mr. Breech full powers in all departments, I know that he's not going to favor me, not when he's got his own man in here.
Right.
So I said, it's ridiculous. I said, gee whiz, I'm just wasting my time, and the only thing I would be is an obstruction here.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, if it's all right with you, I'd just soon go traveling, which I did.
Well, then you came back to Florida to your first love, boats?
Oh, yeah, I came down.
With no regrets?
No. Mm-hmm. I gave my wife a place on Grosse Isle, and my first wife.
Mm-hmm.
And she took over up there and married some little punk up there, and a little kind of a rah-rah boy. And after about 6 months, why, I got a call, come down, pick her up, come up and get her, see?
Mm.
She was dissatisfied, so we fooled around for a couple of years. After that, she came down the boat, stayed on a big houseboat. I just want to pin a picture
here, oh,
at
yes.
the top there.
Oh, yes.
And we cruised around, and and I'd go down, stay in Palm Beach on the boat, and I'd go down to the house and spend 2-3 days down there. And
mm-hmm.
we had a lot of mutual friends down there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we got along fine. We just decided it wasn't appropriate. And she had a couple of boyfriends down there, and I had a couple of gals in Palm Beach. And finally, I met Evie down there, and that was it.
Mm.
But we still. Incidentally, the funny thing is, up in Tryon, North Carolina, where my sister lives, has
mm-hmm.
lived up there many years.
Mm-hmm.
This guy that she finally married, he's a sculptor, some one of these arty types,
mm-hmm.
but his mother has a lot of money, see? He hasn't got a nickel to bless himself with. So, but we used to see a lot of each other down there, you know. We'd come in with a boat at Pompano, and we'd come aboard and have drinks and all.
Mm-hmm.
And she since has given up down Pompano. They're living up in Tryon, where my sister lives up there, see?
Mm-hmm.
So she's right back in the same family mixture.
Incredible.
Of course, Evie doesn't like part of her.
Yeah, right.
Ever they get together on the boat, and they're like a couple of cats. Of course, Gert, my first wife, a very beautiful gal,
mm-hmm.
a very fine woman, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, we don't have any children.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever they get together, why, of course, Gert didn't like the idea that I'd turn her down. I was going to have her back again. And then,
mm-hmm.
boy, it was Evie sitting right there at the yacht basin.
Mm-hmm.
And Evie would come aboard, and I boat her. Gert would come aboard, and they'd get kind of jealous of each other, see?
Mm-hmm.
And then if they had to get in a party or something, each one got a couple of drinks too much, well, they'd start to fly at each other. We have a lot of fun kidding about
it. I'll bet you do. Well, you had a marvelous career.